talking about family systems, attachment theory, and the Imago Dei. And that sounds way headier than it really is. Those are just fancy words that I use to let you think that I'm smart. Okay? So before we do that, let me talk about my family just a little bit. Most of you know us. If you go to the, that's me and my wife, of course, Trudy. She's awesome. We celebrate 20 years this November. We're pretty excited about that. Our next slide, that's my son, Blake. He is out in Colorado. That's where he lives. And, of course, Charlie Grace, who we just took away to college about a week ago, and she's completely forgotten about us already. I never get a text from her. We've got the Twinkies there. They were all grown up. They're freshmen in high school this year. That's a friend. So let me tell you a story about a friend. Friend showed up on our porch one day and never left. And I told the kids, don't give this, our new friend, a name. Because then you tend to keep him, right? And so they just named him Friend. And he's been with us for 5 years now. But he's fat and lazy. Beyond my family here, we've got all these adopted kids from years of youth ministry that we've worked in. We love them so much. We've worked with them for years. Continue to work with kids in our community, and they become part of our extended family. I've had the privilege of actually helping, I was going to say marrying youth ministry students, but that sounds a little funny. Facilitating weddings for some of our students, helping them kind of launch their own families. I'm a youth ministry grandfather now because we babysit for the Evans occasionally. That's pretty cool to have a second generation to minister to is really an honor. I've become fascinated with adolescent development and family systems as a result. See, when I started in youth ministry, I had a pretty good Bible background. I knew nothing about families and kids, right? Or the psychology of development, what they were going through, and all that other stuff. I could throw some scripture at them, right? But I had no idea what to do when Whitney showed up with scars up and down her arms. Right? I had no clue. So went back and got my degree, and now have the opportunity to share that with other people sometimes too. Next slide there. So there's my extended family, my kids there. Blake and Alima, and inside Alima's belly there is my grandbaby, Q. Cutest baby ever. All right? Sorry if that makes your baby look like a troll. It's not my fault. Okay? That was awful. And then my extended family. So my sister-in-law married Kevin Hill. He's a pastor here in Peoria. And those are his two boys, my nephews, Kyle and Cameron. And that's our guy Fabian that you see here. He's with us through foster care. And he's with us. And so our family's become pretty diversified. And this photo right here was taken last Christmas. This photo is amazing. So if you see, there's all different kinds of pigmentation on that picture, right? And that's really cool to me. But there's also older gentleman in the back. He's from Norway. My mother, who is the tiny one in the green sweater there, she's from Greece, right? We've got a foster boy with us. We've got just four generations represented here. Like, it's just a big, beautiful family, right? And I just love it so much. So I want to talk about the problems that come along with that, right? All right, next slide here. All right, let's talk about family systems. So what are family systems? Everything operates on a system. The universe, our body, our relationships, they all operate on systems. And those systems have some rules, all right? So families have interrelated elements and structures, right? There's an order to things most of the time, right? And they govern how we interact with each other and the world around us. We have patterns that we follow, right? Think about some of your personal relationships at home. There are patterns of behavior, right, that you engage in on a regular basis. And they just become routine, and at some point, you just stop thinking about them. This is what you do. Okay? Families tend to have boundaries that are either open or closed, and those really govern what's acceptable behavior and what's not acceptable behavior within a family context. And that varies depending on a lot of other factors. Typically, in the ideal family, the sum is greater. The whole is greater than the sum, right? That the whole well-being of the family should supersede individual needs and desires and wants and that sort of thing as well. There are messages and rules that shape relationships and the roles we play, and we're going to go through those in just a few minutes. And then there are subsystems. One of my favorite stories to tell about our family subsystem is, of course, we have twins, right? If you know anything about twins, they love to fight with each other like it's a sport, okay? And so they argue with each other all the time. But if you mess with one of them, you get the other one too, all right? So the way this works is I'll go to work, Trudy will go to work, my son's out of the house, Charlie Grace was in charge, she was babysitting the kids, right? Which is an awful abuse to heap on a child if you have twins in the family, but it is. And then they would start fighting with each other. Twins would start fighting with each other. And Charlie would go upstairs and she would say to Claire or Chloe, whoever was the instigator, you need to stop that and leave your sister alone. And you know what happened? The other one turned on her. She went up to become an ally for the one who was being harassed by the other one, and then they would both gang up on her. It's like a system within a system within a system. It's an inception of family systems, right? So we've got all these different subsystems. Think about the subsystems in your home, right? Some of you might have a favorite child. I know you'd never admit it publicly, but I think Justin, you guys have a favorite child. Yeah. I mean, I don't have to choose from, but did you guys see his dinosaur video the other day? I nearly wet myself. It was so funny. Yeah. Oh, rah! If you haven't, we should put it up on the screen at some point. But we've got these subsystems, right? And they're really important to pay attention to. And then the goal of a family system is to maintain balance and unity and order, okay? Because when there's order, people can thrive in that family system. Okay, if there's dysfunction, disorder, that really impacts the development of everyone in that system. Okay, so when we think about homeostasis, I want you to think about a mobile in a baby's, over a baby's crib, all right? Now, if you look, this one here in particular, I picked the planets for a reason, because the sun is the center of all of that, right? And the sun is the big one that everything else kind of rotates around. And each of those other weights counterbalance. So when at rest, the mobile is balanced, okay? But if something happens that pulls one of those planets out of orbit, the whole thing just goes wonky, right? There you go. It's another word, like blather, that nobody uses. And so the goal, though, of those counterweights is to restore balance. That's why it's counterweighted the way it is. So it can bring it back to like unity, right? Bring it back to center. And so that's the purpose of this. So I'm going to keep referring back to this image. So I want you to think about that for a few minutes and hang on to it. All right, let's jump from family systems to attachment theory, and then I'm going to tie it all together. So attachment theory is really just how trust is developed in our relationships. All right. As a child, when a newborn is born, usually for the first 6 weeks, they're just asocial. They don't really socialize. They just poop and cry a lot, and that's about it. But after about 6 weeks to 7 months, they have some indiscriminate attachment, meaning they'll go to anybody and they'll take care of them. Anybody that will feed them, right? Just like, here, right? Feed me, change me, put me to bed. But after about 7 to 9 months, they develop a very specific attachment. That's usually to the mother. One of the things that facilitates this type of attachment is close physical bonding. It creates a chemical release in the brain called oxytocin, which helps form bonds, all right? And oxytocin is actually what Paul Zak, who wrote a book called The Moral Molecule, it's the basis of trust and morality. Super cool. Watch the TED Talk on it. It's fantastic. But the idea there is that the more attached I am to you in healthy ways, the less likely I'm going to do something to harm you, right? And that's facilitated through this physical contact and through other behaviors you can engage in that produce this oxytocin, which forms an emotional bond to someone else. This is often created through breastfeeding, when infants breastfeed, or when they're held skin-to-skin contact. There's a lot of this attachment that occurs because of the production of oxytocin. But then after 10 months to a year, you'll see some multiple attachments. These are usually to people who are known to the child, okay? Not necessarily to just any stranger. In fact, you can almost always tell when a child has an attachment disorder. This is not universal, but just almost always, is that when they're a year and a half to 2 years old and you pass them off to a stranger and they don't cry, because they should cry. They're being taken away and given to someone else they don't have a trusting relationship with, right? And so that's a sign that someone has kind of maybe a distorted attachment style that's been impacted for a lot of reasons, trauma, emotional stuff. So this other thing happens, is that the reason attachment happens, so mom's holding baby, she's breastfeeding, lots of physical contact, oxytocin, and then she puts the baby down. Baby's scared to leave because it doesn't know what it can trust and it can't trust, but then it starts to kind of like wander away from mom. Looks back and sees mom, and then goes running back to mom because mom is her secure home base. Okay? But at some point, that child's going to need to venture out to college and leave you at home by yourself crying in puddles of water every night. But so in order to do that, though, she needs to know that I can walk away and this isn't going to go anywhere. This is always here. So I've got a safe place to come back to. Now, that doesn't happen in the baby's brain for a number of months. It's called object permanence. The baby's brain literally does not know that if I can't see it, it doesn't exist. That's what it thinks. Okay? Does that make sense? And so this thing happens where they start to wander farther and farther away, and now they go around the corner, and they can't see mom, and they're still okay until something startles them, and then they go running back, and they see that mom is still there, and like, oh, it's okay, right? And that's how they learn to explore the world around them. And if there's a secure sense of attachment, then they can explore the world around them without heightened levels of fear and anxiety, and they can explore, and they can learn, and they can eventually thrive, right? Because fear isn't the driving motivator, okay? All right, next slide, I'm going to show you some the different styles of attachment theory. So a positive, you've got thoughts about yourself. That has a lot to do with attachment as well. And then you've got thoughts about others. So if your thought about yourself is positive and your thought about others, your experience of living positive with other people, you will have a much more secure attachment. You will likely have higher self-esteem because you'll think highly of yourself. Have higher social ability because you're learning how to trust and who to trust. Does that make sense? All right. As you move over here, if your thoughts about yourself are negative, but they're positive about other people, you're going to have anxious attachment. And what that looks like is lower self-esteem but higher social ability. Now, in order to compensate for the low self-esteem, I need you to affirm me because that's where I get my worth from, twos, right? Where are we at? Woo-hoo. All right, yeah, okay. Then you go to positive thoughts about self and negative thoughts about others, all right? What you have is a dismissive attachment. And so you have high self-esteem and lower social ability. This is your narcissist group, right? I don't need anybody else, or I'm better than everybody else, or I can't trust anybody else, right? It's just me against the world, and it's a very solo flight kind of experience. And then you've got what many would say is the worst, is the fearful attachment, which is low self-esteem and low social ability, right? This is an individual who's at high risk for a lot of potential things, right? We're going to dive into this a little bit more. Go ahead and go to the next slide, Sarah. So as the brain develops, start when we're really young, right? If you look there, the blue parts of the brain are the part that's more matured. The other colors are not so much. Look at a five-year-old brain. The part that's most mature is the fight or flight, kind of sympathetic nervous system response back here, the part that controls your breathing and your heart rate and all that kind of stuff. And then, but if you ever met a five-year-old, they're a little irrational sometimes, or all the time, because the front of their brain's not developed fully, right? It's during these formative years, and before that, is where attachment starts to develop. And if it's not developed in healthy ways, in appropriate ways, as they travel through, their brain never wires around secure attachment and trust, right? Which is why we have disorders like reactive attachment disorder, okay? It's disrupted that process, so they struggle to attach to people in meaningful ways as children and as adults. As you move into the preteen brain, I remember my son when he was a preteen. If you've had a nine-year-old and you've ever looked at them and said, why would you do such a thing? And they look at you and say, what? I don't know. Really? Why would you put a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the VCR? I don't know. It was a slot and it was bread and it looked like it was, it just went there. They literally don't have any rational thought at this front. The smart part of their brain is up here and it is yellow as can be. All right. So there's very little rationality that goes on inside the mind of that. But look, what's getting blue? The emotional part of the brain. Like, why can't I put bologna in my whatever? I don't know. So you see that now. Go to the teen. Much more heightened, much more developed, still maturing. You've got blue all over the place and purple. Still have some green spots, right? So right here in the temporal lobes, it's That's where emotions and anger are controlled. That's why you get angry teenagers, right? This part's still a little underdeveloped. And then the brain finally forms, and what we would call hardwired. Don't be misled by that term, hardwired. It's still malleable. It can still change and develop, but becomes more mature. And you see that that brain, if part of a healthy, vibrant, supportive, attachment-style family will develop, and that child doesn't have to worry about its survival. Okay, so it can focus on other things. Like, how do I get along with the world that I live in? How do I interpret the world that I live in? How do I make plans for myself in the future? You with me? Okay, next step. One other thing that's going on is this cognitive process, too. When we're really young and our brains are underdeveloped, we think in terms of black or white. And as we move through that kind of that preteen to teenage years, we develop more abstract thinking. It's really important because when you're a child and we tell children, that's bad, you shouldn't do that, the child interprets that as, I'm bad. Because they don't have the ability to go, oh, okay, what I did was wrong. Maybe I shouldn't do that anymore, but I'm still fundamentally a good person. Right? That's abstract. That's the difference between the two. So if the messages the child is receiving over and over and over again are messages of negativity, of shame, of discouragement, of dysfunction, that starts to become hardwired into their narrative. Okay? And that impacts their ability to attach with people. So now as I move through adulthood into a brain that has become more hardwired, I carry that with me. And that leads to, what's the next part here? Oh, family dynamics. Okay, so that's not really my uncle. That was me before I went on a diet. Okay, so family dynamics comprise of kind of four things here. So we've got boundaries, rules that govern roles and maladaptive behavior. So when a family is dysfunctional, when there's negative influence over that family system, when the mobile is kind of unbalanced all the time because there's no counterbalance and there's no weight to it. So imagine alcoholism wreaking havoc on a family, right? Imagine domestic abuse. Imagine mental illness, right? I'll tell you a little bit more about our story with mental illness in a little bit. But my son has bipolar disorder, and that has thrown our mobile out of whack for years, and we've had to respond to it to try to bring some equilibrium back. Okay? So let's talk about this. When the family's dysfunctional, we're learning this other negative narrative. Go to the next slide here. We talk about boundaries that are either too rigid or too loose. Okay? So a rigid boundary is one in which you can't make any error whatsoever, because if you do, you're going to screw everything up. Okay? Then there's loose boundaries, whereas you might draw a line, but I don't really care where the line is. I'm going to do whatever I want whenever I want. Okay? So an example of a loose boundary is you're a teenager out on your first date, and he gets a little handsy with you. And you say, stop, I don't like that, and he completely disregards it. And you don't do anything. You don't dig your heels in again. That's a loose boundary, right? Then you just push right through that. All right, as a result of the rigid or loose boundaries, people develop rules for how to survive in a dysfunctional family system. Like, you have to do this to survive. If the family's not going to work towards finding some balance on that mobile, you've got different rules. Because you're shifting from thriving in a healthy world to surviving. So how do we survive? We don't talk about things. We don't talk about things that are going to upset the apple cart. We don't talk about emotions. We don't talk about the problems we have and what you're doing. We just ignore it, right? We don't feel either. In a dysfunctional family system, there's probably one emotion that's acceptable. Anybody want to take a guess as what it is? Anger, right? Expressed in the myriad of ways that it can be expressed. So anger is appropriate, but other than that, you don't feel. You don't feel sad. You don't feel disappointed. You don't feel hurt. It's not that. You ever told as a kid, like, knock that crying off. I'm going to give you a reason to cry. Right? So I'm like, I already have a reason to cry. That's why I'm crying. Like, I don't need another reason. So another way that we take the heat off ourselves in this dysfunctional family system is we blame everybody else. Right? If I can rise above, if I can deflect the blame to someone else, then I can survive this system that's really screwed up right now. Okay? All right, and then we minimize things. I didn't really hit her. I just slapped her, you know. Like, that's how we minimize things. And then we just completely deny, right? This is called gaslighting, right? Is when we make the other person, we do bad things to somebody else, and we make them think that it's their fault or that what they're seeing isn't real, right? And so those are things that we do as a result of that. And because of that, everybody kind of finds themselves playing certain roles in these dysfunctional families as a means of surviving. Okay? Who was the hero in your family? Right? Who was the child that rose above it all? They got the scholarships. They were the athlete, right? They were the one that was successful. That was the person that the rest of the family could say, see, we're not so screwed up after all. At least we've got this, right? And for every hero, there's an anti-hero. It's a scapegoat. They're the cause of all the problems. If you've ever heard, why can't you be more like your... There's a good chance you were the scapegoat. Okay? That's the person that often... as the hero's excelling, this is the one that's not, this is the one that's struggling, and as a means of interacting in that system, they just kind of surrender to this idea that this is what I am, right? There's the mascot. I was a mixture of the hero and the mascot. I was the clown. I was the one that kind of liked to keep everything lighthearted so that Dad wouldn't lose his mind and yell and scream, and, you know, like, I was that guy. Then there's the lost child. There's the one that plays by themselves with their imaginary friends in their rooms because they just want to stay out of the way. As the family system gets more and more dysfunctional, I'm just going to hide. You mess with the scapegoat. You love your hero. I'm going to be over here playing by myself. And they're often just ignored because there's too much other chaos going on. You've got the martyr. For me, God bless her. I absolutely adored her. She was one of my favorite human beings ever. But my grandmother was a martyr, right? If I had a dollar for every time I heard her say, I just do so much for all of you and I just get no thanks in return. Right? And it's like, thank you for saying that. But then there's the enabler. There's always somebody that keeps this system running. In many cases, in the world that I work in with substance abuse, it's the spouse. Right? Mom shows up after a big drinking binge. She can't go to work the next day, so Dad calls up the boss and lies to him. She's homesick today. She'll be in tomorrow. And they're the ones that kind of protect everyone from feeling the consequences of what's going on. They're the one that crafts the fake narrative that we all corporately share to the rest of the world. Okay? There's others that you could go through as well, but I wanted you to see that these roles are either assigned or people fall into them as a means of navigating this whole dysfunctional family system. All right? Okay, next slide. So what's the result of that? Well, this is all that can come out of it, right? Substance abuse, violence, self-harm, dangerous, high-risk sexual behavior, obsessive-compulsive habits like overeating, shopping, gambling, working, criminal activity, emotional grooming, and a distorted self-image. Like, you can't escape from a really dysfunctional family without it impacting the way you see yourself and the way you see the world. What happens is we develop these things that Jean Piaget called schemas. Okay? These schemas, go to the next slide here, the next one. It is an extremely stable, enduring negative pattern of thinking and behaving that develops during childhood or adolescence and is elaborated throughout an individual's life. We view the world through our schemas. What I tell people, it's the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves and the world that we live in. Okay? They're very stable, they're hard to change, but they're important beliefs and feelings about oneself and the environment in which we accept without question most of the time. They are self-perpetuating and are very resistant to change. So for instance, children who develop schemas that they are incompetent rarely challenge us to believe even as adults. Schema usually does not go away without therapy. Overwhelming success in people's lives is often still not enough to change the schema. The schema has a life of its own and fights for its survival. And the way that it does that is through something we call confirmation bias. So, for example, I heard the word, that's really dumb, Chris. Why would you do that? That's so stupid. What are you, an idiot? Are you retarded? What is your problem? I heard this over and over from various sources. So what do you think I started to believe about myself? I'm stupid, right? Like, I can't do anything right. I'm an idiot. I'm never going to achieve anything, right? So that was my schema that developed. And then in response to my schema, I operate one of three ways. Go to the next slide here. I either avoid anything that's going to activate that schema. All right, so complete avoidance, or I completely surrender to it. Fine, you say I'm an idiot, I'm not even going to try anymore. All right, or I overcompensate. Guess what? I'm going to learn everything I can learn about everything, and I'm going to learn big words so I can tell you big words so that you'll think I'm super smart. When in reality, I don't really think I am. Right? So the best way to avoid disappointment... It's obviously not to expect anything at all. Or just surrender, or no offense to anybody who drives a big pickup truck, you overcompensate. Okay? I changed that picture. I'm going to tell you, now that I'm telling you, I probably shouldn't have. It was a picture of our president originally, but then I changed it to avoid. But now I just said it, so I didn't. Okay, change the slide. So here's another example, right? So if the schema that's developed is social isolation, so Anne's core schema is social isolation or alienation. She sees herself as being so different from other people that she doesn't fit in anywhere. So when she does things as part of a group, she does not really get involved. That's surrender, right? At times, she gets very hostile towards group members and can be very critical of the group as a whole, which is overcompensation. At other times, she chooses to avoid group activities altogether, which is avoidance. Sorry, surrender, compensation, avoidance. And every time you engage in one of those behaviors, you reinforce the schema. All right? You actually give it more strength. It grows stronger inside you. And that story that you're telling yourself gets embedded deeper and deeper into your identity, your being. All right. Okay, next slide. So confirmation bias comes in here. So now, every time I got an F on a test, that just confirmed the schema that everybody else was right and I'm stupid. Right? Every time Anne didn't feel like she fit in somewhere or her friends didn't call her, even if she didn't tell them she wanted to go or do anything, she would interpret that through the lens of her schema, saying, see, I don't fit anywhere. I'm never going to belong anywhere. So this is who I am. I can tell you right now, cover your kids' ears just real quick. Here's a statement I hear all the time when clients walk into my office. I am a big piece of... That's the narrative they bring in with them. So one of the first things I tell them when you come in, you sit down in my chair, I said, I want you to know, this is a POS-free zone. There's no such thing as that, okay? And I remember something one of my professors taught me years ago, is that for every human being, I want you to think about everything we've talked about so far, they are the product of a process that's been going on their whole lives, okay? Somebody just woke up one day and said, I think I'm a piece of crap now. Like, it's something that's developed, and it's become so almost subconscious because it's just wired into us, okay? Making sense? Believing is seeing. Once we have a belief, we see the information that will confirm that belief, and we stop seeing what we don't want to see. We want to see the information that confirms our beliefs, and we want to forget anything that is dissonant or discrepant. I want you to think about like confirmation bias as like Google search engine. Okay? You know, if you type in, what was the name of the dude that shot the people of the Bible study in Charleston, South Carolina, the kid. Is that Dylan Roof? Okay. All right. So they went back through a lot of his internet stuff, right? And what they found is that he would search for white supremacy, and it would bring up information, right? And then he would search for black-on-black crime, and it would bring up lots of data on black-on-black crime, right? And the more he searched for things, the more Google generates similar searches and responses to his original search. Does that make sense? And the more you do that, the more you're going to see. So what it does is it doesn't expand your world. It actually shrinks your world down to just the same kind of stuff that confirms what you're already searching for. Okay? This is how Facebook works. This is how Google works. And it brings it all right to your face. So it looks like black-on-black crime is a real thing, even though the real data shows it's not. Right? That's why it looks like there are white nationalists everywhere, because that's all that it's bringing up, right? Next thing you know, it's Facebook ads or about white supremacy groups, right? Which is why anytime somebody asks me to come fix their computer, I can tell what they've been doing by looking at their Facebook ads. They ain't always pretty, but... So that's confirmation bias. That's how our mind works. And then it reinforces everything. Okay, next slide here. So let me play this out, and then I'm going to get to, like, I move away from family in a micro way. It's like, what's this got to do with us as a church? Because it's got everything to do with us as a church. All right? So, some kind of painful event occurs, right? And what happens is we have this distorted thinking, this faulty narrative we have about ourselves and the world we're in. I interpret that event in a distorted manner, right? I lose my job. It's just downsizing. The boss tries to tell me that, but because I have a schema that I can't do anything right, when that event happens to me, then the boss says, listen, this isn't because you've done anything wrong. We just have to downsize. My schema tells me he's lying to me because he doesn't want to hurt my feelings. I've done a crappy job. See, I can't do anything right. And if that assumption goes unchallenged, I now have to find a way to resolve that dissonance that's inside of me. And I do that through some of those rules that we talked about earlier, right? I blame people, I minimize, I deny, right? I don't feel, I just that's how I deal with it. That's how I bring equilibrium back to my inner being, all right? But if I engage in destructive choices, so maybe I go home that night and I get drunk, right? Maybe I go home and I yell at my kids. Maybe I self-harm, whatever the case is. On the other side of that are more negative emotions as a result of the thing I've chosen to do, which reinforced the schema. See, I can't do anything right. I'm just a screw-up. I'm just a blight on everyone else. Maybe it'd be better if I wasn't here at all. Right? Which leaves me increasingly vulnerable to the next event. This doesn't happen in a linear, like, one event, two event, three event. Like, it's like this all the time. Right? And the more it happens, the faster and more muddy it seems to get. All right. You with me? We're going to turn the corner here. All right. You good? All right. Okay. Go to the next slide here. There is hope, though. Right? So we all carry this to some degree. We're always challenging assumptions, and we all have them. Sometimes we don't even know them. But there is hope. So let's imagine a world in which we experience painful events. Can't avoid them. Okay? If you can engage in some rational thinking, what I believe Scripture calls the renewing of the mind, thinking of yourself in the world in sober judgment, right? Thinking rationally and clearly. Then we can embrace the truth about the reality, but not attach it to our identity. Okay, this goes back to what we were talking about with kids earlier, right? The difference between you're bad or, oh, I did something that was wrong, but I'm still inherently good, right? From there, then we can risk vulnerability to talk through those things, to deal with them and walk through them, which allows me to make more life-giving choices. And when I do that, I experience more positive emotions on the other side of that, which reinforces my new identity. We're going to get to the Imago Dei part of this in just a minute, which leaves me with social work world, we call it increased self-efficacy, but mostly that just means hope that I can make a better life for myself. Hope that I can maybe learn from this and change and grow and be better. Okay? All right, so next slide. So this is, I'm not going to steal this because it would be awful to steal my friend's book, but this narrative here is really important, and this is why it's so important, and why I can't wait for Danielle to come and share the heart of her book with you all. Is because I think for many of us, theologically, our starting point and how we see ourselves and how we see the world is Genesis 3. It's at the fall, right? We've been taught that through many of our contemporary evangelical churches, that it's about you're fallen, you're a sinner, you need redemption, and our starting point is you are broken and sinful, okay? And what happens is throughout the course of our lives, in family systems, in church systems, often those messages are reinforced. You're not enough. You're not good enough. God couldn't love you because you're covered in sin. And at home, oh, you're bad. You shouldn't do that. Or what's wrong with you, right? You're never, ever good enough. Okay? And so I would argue, and Daniel will do a much better job explaining this when she comes, is that we're starting at the wrong place theologically for our narrative. So where we need to start is in Genesis 1, where we are created in the image of God, built for community, and we are called as beloved. Okay? Because I think that matters. Because when we can rest in that versus this here, that changes the narrative. If I'm inherently deficient and broken and worthless apart from Him, but over here, I am created in God's image and I'm inherently good, that challenges all the schemas. It challenges all the world's narratives to tell us that we're not enough the way we are. Next slide. So how do we shift the way we live, the way we behave, and the way we do things, right? I think it's important we ask ourselves, where are our theological starting points? I want you to think about, forget about your family now, because most of you have probably been thinking about like your family, your immediate family. I want you to think about us as a church. We operate on the same systems. Listen, there are scapegoats at the church. There are heroes at the church. There's enablers at the church. You know, like there's the lost people, right? That maybe don't seem like they've got any leadership skills to give to the church. but are mopping the floors every day and nobody gives them a second look, right? There are people that are doing work that we don't even know about and they're lost in the background there. So this applies to our church as a whole. Churches in general, just large organizations of people. So what's our theological starting point? Everybody that walks through the door, our theological starting point with that person, with ourselves, should be Genesis 1. That person just walked through as a child of God. End of story, no other questions, right? And so then, if that's true, how do we extend radical hospitality, right? So at the syringe exchange that I run in Peoria, we get what most would call the dredges of life. Like we're commercial sex workers. We get strung out heroin addicts, right? We get sex offenders, right? We get homeless teenagers. We get queer kids that come in. And they walk through the door, and most of them, I think particularly of one guy recently who walks in, and he's like, is this the syringe place? Just really sheepish, really like guarded. I'm like, yeah, man, come on in, right? And so the very first thing we do when they come in, we offer them a bottle of water or soda, offer them a snack, and have them sit down on our couch. And we go over and sit with them on the couch, and then we just talk to them. That's it. You are welcome here. No judgment here. I don't care what you're doing to your body or right now. Like, I just want you to know you're welcome here. Because if we can't get past that, he's never going to develop the trust for me to engage in him further so I can maybe direct him to some of the help that he needs. Right? And so what we find is that if we do this well, within just a few short visits, they're telling us their life story. Right? And I'm talking intimate details about their sexual history, their drug using history, their family of origin issues. To show somebody your IV scars is one of the most vulnerable things you can do. Right? And so to be able to sit there and look at them and go, oh, I see you've really kind of messed this up. Let me tell you about a different way to do that so you reduce the harm you're doing to yourself while you're still using. I know you don't want to use. I know there's enough treatment for you, but how can we help you inject safer? Right? That's radical hospitality that tells people you matter and your health matters and your life matters. And if I can get you to maybe care about that, then maybe you'll make start making positive changes. Any positive change. That make sense? Okay. Does everybody have buy-in? It's not any good if you've got a family member that's working against the cause, right? They have their own agenda. That doesn't work well. If you've got a strong-willed child, you know that to be true, right? So is everybody on the same page? No more pretending. We just have to call it what it is, right? I can tell you right now, I love you guys. I really, and girls, sorry, non-gender. Last 6 months have been hell for me. Really struggled with some depression. I've got some awful stuff going on in my family. And it's been really hard. And many of you have loved me through this, not judged us because of what's happening. And it's been a beautiful, beautiful thing. Without it, you also gave me space when I needed space. Right? You've sent me hug emojis just out of the blue. Knowing I wasn't going to text you back, right? And that, like, we need vulnerability. We need to stop pretending. This isn't always easy. Listen, life sucks sometimes, right? And this, maybe more than any other place, your family or your body of church needs to be the safest place on the planet, right? If it's not, I don't know what we're doing. All of us need to continue to grow. If we're going to be radically hospitable and we're going to continue to allow people into our spaces and share our spaces and let them have ownership over the same spaces, we also need to grow our emotional, social, and cultural intelligence. That's really important, especially the cultural intelligence, right? Is understanding the context of everyone else's lives. And to care about things that matter to others, I think is super important in a family system, a small family unit, but then as a larger body as well. And then I would just say this, life happens in the poop piles, and that's where we need to be, right? I changed that slide, honestly, that word, so just so you know that. Yeah. So here's why, because I love the image of Jesus going outside the city walls and where he would hang out, where he would meet some of the most destitute people were in the crap piles, literally crap piles. It's where all the waste from the city would wash out to. It's where the garbage was dumped. And it's out there that he would meet some of the dredges of society that he would encounter and interact with and touch, physically touch. You know that oxytocin thing going on? Makes you feel like you're loved and you can trust this person? That was happening. So I think sometimes we can become insulated inside of our own little system, and that we need to step outside of it sometimes, right? Okay, next slide. All right, so what are the different kinds of systems? I just want you to think through this. What are your internal systems, your familial systems, just the body of people, your corporate system, your community, your neighborhood has a system and the way it operates, right? I feel like we might be the scapegoats on our block, right? We're the loud family with all the kids that never mows their yard, right? And really, we don't ever mow our yard. It's gross. City and state has a system that's in place, right? That you are a part of and you play a role in. Our nation and then our global citizenship, right? He tells us to go into all the world, right? Judea, Samaria, and all the world. Did I get that right? Okay, so here's what I want to do. I want to tie this all together with you, all right? I just want you to sit back and listen for a few minutes. I'm going to read scriptures to you. I'm going to read several scriptures to you. I just want you to cling to them. Just listen to them. Let them settle in, because it's going to drive this point home, right? And then we'll wrap up and we'll go to our benediction here. 1 Corinthians 1:10 says, I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree with one another in what you say, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly united in mind and thought. Think about the mobile hanging in unity and balance. Ephesians 4:11-13. So Christ himself gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors and teachers to equip his people for works of service so the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. We exist and fight for unity so that we can build each other up, so that we can all attain the full measure of Christ. Colossians 3:13-14 say, bear with each other and forgive one another. If any of you has a grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. Over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. This is how we restore balance when the mobile becomes upset. John 17:23 says, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them, even as I have, as you have loved me. This is how the world knows, right? It's when we love each other as family well. Psalm 133:1 says, how good and pleasant is it when God's people live together in unity. 1 Peter 3:8 says, finally, all of you, be like-minded. Be sympathetic. Love one another. Be compassionate and humble. 1 John 4:12 says, no one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. And Ephesians 4:3 says, make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. Romans 12:16 says, live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Philippians 2:1 says, therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion. When we start with the Imago Dei as the genesis of our narrative, we can challenge all that stuff that pulls us away from that, right? When I forget about that, like so many of you have done over the last 6 months, and you've reminded me of that, it's what pulls me back. Yeah, the Wellbutrin helped some. Yeah, the therapy helped some. But more than anything, reminding me that I belong to this body of Christ and that my identity comes not just through Christ, but through all of you as Christ expresses himself through you. That's what brought me back to wholeness, or is bringing me back to wholeness. Does that make sense? Right? And so when people act the way we do, when we do the things that we do that are harmful to ourselves, I genuinely think the underlying spiritual issue is because we have forgotten. We have forgotten. And that impacts our families, and impacts our churches and our communities and our world. So I just pray today that we all remember the Imago Dei in us, and that we set down any of the roles that have been assigned to us that are faulty and that are contradictory to the Imago Dei, and that you walk in freedom and then you find healing in all of that. But maybe one day, right, we'll get it figured out. Right? Amen. Thanks.